high-resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
Welcome to This Week in Retro for the week of November 16th, 2020. Coming up on today's show...
Fujinet for the Atari 8-bit.
Do you take coffee with your retro?
The Warrior 64 console.
And the ZX Spectrum Next clone.
All this and more on This Week in Retro.
Up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.
Neil, as you may be aware, the Atari 8-bit computer line has a special place in my heart. When my dad brought home the 1200XL he'd bought from a neighbor in 1986, it introduced me to the world of electronics, programming, and of course, video games. Through the years, the items in my collection have come and gone, but the one computer I've kept for all of these years is my beloved Atari 1200XL. I actually have it set up right next to me in a permanent location right next to my podcasting desk. Now, Neil, I know that you've recently rebuilt an Atari 800XL as part of your Trash to Treasure series. Have you played with it much since then?
You know, before I say this, I don't want anyone to think that I'm complaining because I absolutely love what I do for a job. Full-time YouTubing of retro is amazing. But the hobbyist in me screams when I have to pack up a system. You know, I've been working on it to make the film, and then I have to pack it up to make space because I've only got a limited amount of space. So in answer to your question, no. I haven't had a huge amount of time to play on the 800XL since recording that, but that is about to change because... drumroll, on the 1st of December, I get the keys to a new cave, which is very exciting. Yeah, it's great. So instead of the, I have about 30 meters squared in the current cave, I'm going to have 250 meters squared plus. It's huge, huge
space. A mammoth cave.
All open plan. It's amazing. So, of course, the first thing I'm going to do is set up an exhibition space. The 800XL is going to be there. All the other Trash to Treasure machines permanently set up. And regardless of what I'm filming in the studio, I'll be able to walk over there, switch on the machines and play with them. So it'll be a retro heaven. And the Atari 8-bit, they're top of my list of systems that I need to further explore. So yes, not yet, but I will be exploring the 800XL a lot more. But the 1200XL that you've got, that's an incredibly desirable machine. And I do love the origin stories. You mentioned just up there that your dad had bought it from a neighbor in 1986. And I bet, even though you were very young, I bet that's an incredibly vivid memory of when that happened for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I still remember the first time I saw it. I remember the first time I loaded it up. Of course, you know, I was with my dad, but I still remember him teaching me how to spell various program names. Like, you know, just like all fine, upstanding citizens, all of our software was pirated. And I remember him showing me how to load a disk through DOS. And then he's like, okay, you need to type onon.exe. Or I think I've spelled that wrong, actually. One-on-one was what he was trying to spell for. Obviously, his lesson fell on deaf ears. But at any rate, yeah, the 1200XL, it's a system that I will take with me to the grave. I love it. And for all the love I have for the machine, I'm always looking to find more uses for it than firing up, you know, the occasional video game. And I've found this really cool new thing called Fujinet. This thing was programmed by two guys, Joe Honnold and Thomas Cherry Holmes. And these two guys are Atari computer enthusiasts to the max. This is the most exciting peripheral I think that I've ever seen for the system itself. Definitely the most exciting since it was canceled commercially in 1992. The Fujinet adapter was originally conceived just as a way for Atari computers to easily call into BBS systems. But as they were programming this thing, they realized that they could kind of bootstrap a lot of other functionality into this device. You can use it as a floppy emulator, sort of like a GoTech on the Amiga. You can hook it up and use it as a printer interface instead of having to use the Atari 850 printer interface, which is sort of big and bulky. And you can also use it as a peripheral simulator. So it can do all kinds of fun stuff. One application that has been making the particular rounds this week is a program called weather.xex. This is a program that uses the Open Weather database to gather real-time, you guessed it, weather data. Wow. And display it through Fujinet on your Atari's display. Now, you may be asking yourself, why is this exciting? Aren't there a million ways you can look at the weather? Well, of course there are. But Neil, this is a hobby based on useless activity. That's what retro computing is all about. You know, I'm always really sad when I sit down and I'm in the midst of my collection of computers and all the screens are just dark all the time. You know, I love the idea of useful passive applications that I can just leave on in the background while I'm doing other things. And this weather app is not just green text on a blank screen. The weather display itself is full color. It's quite attractive. And like I said, it updates constantly with the current weather. Now, Neil, what other kinds of passive information utilities do you think would be useful for you to have hooked up on an Amiga or an old BBC Micro?
Full color weather reports. That's nerdy even for you, John.
Don't mock me, Neil.
But the sad thing is I'm right there with you. Do you remember that story a few years back about how an Amiga 500 was found to still be controlling the air conditioning systems of a high school?
Yes, I think absolutely.
That was in the US, wasn't it?
It was. It was right here.
Or every now and then you see a hotel pops up in the news and there's a micro still running the welcome message on the TV screens in the rooms. You know, I love the idea of old micros just dutifully performing that one task that's asked of them for years and years with no complaint whatsoever, proud almost to be telling you, you know, the air conditioning is at 21 degrees and my uptime is 10,000 days. You know, I love all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So if, as a part of the new cave, as I described, my Atari 800 could be set up to play games on, but then also to have the display, you know, out on the CRT to pop up and tell me what the weather is or if there are any roadworks on my drive home or anything like that, that would really make me smile just to look at that. I do love that idea. And the way you describe it, it almost sounds like an entire separate computer bolted on the back that it can do all of these multifunctions. And, you know, they're discovering new ways to use it. So it sounds like I've used a bit of kit called the RetroNet, which is purely just goes into the serial port and it, you know, creates a network interface so you can get on BBSs on old school computers. But I don't think it has that depth of functionality that you've just described with the FugiNet. So that does sound very interesting.
The thing that really struck me about it is it really reminds you of the old, here in the States, we had a channel called the Weather Channel. And you guessed it was all weather all the time. But it had a very iconic look, you know, the graphics, the different graphical displays of the different weather patterns and the fonts and everything were very evocative of that time period. And that's what grabbed me about this thing. Now, the FugiNet peripheral itself is open source. You can build one yourself, or you can buy one through several online vendors pre-built for around $60. The weather app itself is free. It's the only sort of application like this that I've seen that is that's been promoted. But I'm sure as the FugiNet, you know, sort of matures, people are going to be writing more and more programs like this because lots of people are into Atari 8-bits. I feel like the system itself is having a little bit of a renaissance right now, and the FugiNet peripheral is definitely on my Christmas list. Want to reach out and thank Mark Central for suggesting this story on our show subreddit.
John, you've lived in the UK. What's your favorite town in the UK?
Neil, I've got to go with the small, humble town of Burnley. Oh, you know,
what a coincidence, John, because Burnley has announced a new retro gaming cafe.
That's just what I thought they were missing.
But I did stifle a laugh, although I'm doing it very badly, when I saw a photo of the venue of this new retro gaming cafe in Burnley, which is in the north of England, for anyone who's not familiar with it. And in this photo, which was printed in the Lancashire News, this new venue for a gaming cafe is a waxing and tanning beauty salon, which presumably is going to be transformed into a retro heaven. But who knows? Maybe we can play some Pac-Man while getting a wax.
I wonder what the Venn diagram of that is like. You know, you're a retro gamer and likely to get their body waxed at a retail location. Where's the overlap?
From the neck down, maybe. Certainly with you and I. Anyway, If you're in the area, then do look it up because it's probably going to be worth checking out. But I chose this story from our subreddit this week really just as a talking point because it feels like we're seeing more and more of this happening now. There are more people of an age, where they want to take their retro passion and turn it into a business. Of course, there are business people out there who see retro as an opportunity and want to tap into it. Either way, I think we're seeing more of this. We're seeing arcades, we're seeing cafes pop up, certainly here in the UK. We're seeing small things like multi-game, like MAME arcade cabinets starting to appear in pubs. You know, anywhere where there's a demographic where they're with an age where they might find these old games appealing. It's not mass market, but it is something I'm noticing more and more here. Are you seeing any of that stateside too?
Well, you know, Neil, I live in a pretty rural area. The population density of my state is something like 70 people per square mile.
Oh, wow.
So, but even here in the hills of West By God, Virginia, the retro business scene is springing up left and right. You know, in addition to your used game stores, your flea market stalls, there's a barcades are coming around. There's a pretty impressive one that actually opened up nearby the campus of our local university. And I went there and it was really nice. I think that they've leased out the machines from companies. I really think that there are companies that do nothing but sort of warehouse old games. And then when somebody wants to open up a retro, you know, any sort of a retro location, they're just like, all right, here's a room full of games for X amount per month. And then you're making money on the food and the drink and all that stuff. But I really think that with the barcade thing, you've got to walk a fine line, especially when you're not in a place that is totally driven toward young professionals, because you have to appeal to families with kids. You know, parents want to bring their kids to these places and show them the games that they grew up playing. Yeah. And so you can't really go too far down the debaucherous path. You know, nobody wants to bring their kids to a place that reeks of beer and, well, you know, other liquids and with the sticky floors and all that. So it's a fine line you've got to walk, I think.
Yeah, I definitely agree. There is that market of a generation wanting to show their children and the next generation just how they enjoyed being entertained. And, you know, a lot of the time they will probably get there, play it for 15 minutes and go, oh, yeah, it was better in my mind. You know, I'm sure that happens a lot.
And that's when you hit the booze, Neil. That's when you need some of that liquid fun.
Exactly. But, you know, this thing is popping up and more. When we talk about this kind of business model, the cafe or the modern arcade, do you think in the one day these are sustainable business models or not? What's your take on it?
I think there is. You can get a successful business out of a location, a retro themed location. But I think the key is you have to take a playbook out of the page that so many online platforms have, and that's what you have to have is you have to have recurring subscription revenue. Now, how do you do that? Well, you've got to establish sort of, you've got your daily rate where you say you walk in and you can play for, you know, $5 or $10, you can play all day, but you can say for $25 a month, you can become a member, you know, of this retro, you know, arcade or whatever you want to call it. And what that gives you is, you know, of course, you can walk in and play anytime, but it also gives you the sense of your belonging to a community. And it's something that you want to keep going. You know, you want to be part of the engine that makes this place happen. And of course, as a business owner, what you want to do is you want to organize special events that are for members only to lure those people in. You know, you can have days where if you have broken consoles, you can bring them in and everybody can work together to fix them. You can schedule talks from, you know, any local luminaries. I don't know how many luminaries currently reside in Burnley, but that's beside the point. You can host contests with prizes. You know, all that kind of thing gives people a sense of belonging to a club, you know, an exclusive club. And they in turn will tell their friends, and that will drive up that membership, and that recurring revenue is what's going to pay the rent, not just the person that walks off the street, you know, once every 6 months and plays a couple rounds of Asteroids.
Yeah, I agree. The more the world becomes connected and the smaller the world feels, the more I think people want to be a part of a community. They want to find their place, their space in the world, don't they? And I'm inclined to agree, there really does have to be a sense of community and of shared experience and of knowing nods between people's, you know, a little nod that just says, yeah, I was there, man. You know, I'm in on the secret. This is my place. These are my people.
Right.
And that's, to be honest, take the retro out of it, and that's the secret to the success of any cafe. You know, they depend on repeat trade and regular people. But if your skills are in retro gaming and not baking, then you need to lean into that to create that kind of environment, as I guess they're doing in Burnley. Maybe they're the best chefs in the world. I don't know what their background is, but, you know, do you think that there is a danger of over-commercializing the retro hobby with ventures like this, of coming across too slickly and too corporate, and perhaps invoking the wrath of the angry gatekeepers of the hobby, because they are out there?
You know, I don't think so. I think that the profit margins in any kind of endeavor like this are so small that most big time corporations are going to stay away. I know that in the UK, they have, I've read about in Retro Gamer, how they have these businesses that are essentially a retro party in a van where they, you know, if you have a space, they'll pull up in front of your space, they'll unload some arcade machines and some consoles, and you can pay them by the hour. Then they load them up and they drive away. But even something like that, nobody's getting rich off that. Nobody is going to have a publicly traded company that's going to become wealthy. I think that the stakes are still too small for, you know, the corporate overlords to want to take over, which is good for us because that's the last thing our hobby needs.
Yeah. And at the other end of the scale, you then go in, you venture into the thing we discussed the other week, like the Atari Hotel. If it becomes corporate, you're heading into those kind of companies.
Mm-hmm.
And companies like Atari, well, they've got the name to do it. Nobody can claim that they're disingenuous. All right, yes, maybe the history of how they got that name is, but the name itself isn't. There's all sorts of pitfalls you can fall into, but I'm inclined to agree. These setups so far, I applaud them all, and I do wish them all the best of luck with this new venture in Burnley. I do hope others come up with the same idea closer to home, because Burnley's up near Manchester and Leeds up in the north of the country. So bring it down south, please. I'd like to see that a lot more. And they do comment in the news story that no interior modification is needed, just a reception area, seating and breakfast bar. This in a tanning salon, remember? So maybe the tanning booths will be part of the design. Maybe you can retro-brite your computers in a tanning booth while you're there. But either way, the very best of luck to them. And if I'm up in the area, I will certainly pay them a visit.
Neil, the N64 continues to be the darling of the console community. Something I never would have believed 10 or 15 years ago. Man, you couldn't give these things away back then. I have an N64 on my shelf that I didn't scrub the price crayon off of. I kid you not, Neil. $3.95 at Goodwill.
Wow.
That's all I paid for this thing. Just out of curiosity, Neil, what's the absolute cheapest console or computer you've ever bought from a charity shop?
Well, over here, you can't really buy electrical items from charity shops unless the shop has the equipment to test them for safety.
Really?
Yeah. The law is unless they've been tested with a PAT tester or a personal appliance tester, I think that's what it's called, and that it's passed those tests and they've put a sticky label on to say that it's passed.
Health and safety. Just they're ruining England.
Is your health and safety gone mad? So retro consoles are hard to come by in charity shops here. I know it's not retro, but the best things I can think of that I came across in charity shops recently, not so long ago, I picked up a Nintendo Switch joypad. This is the official Nintendo one, sealed, boxed as new for £1.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
I don't even have a Switch. I don't even have a Switch, but I had to buy it. And I gave it to a friend who does have a Switch. He was very pleased. So that was a good pickup. What I tend to do is I go to the DVD section in charity shops and I look for PS3, PSP, Xbox games. I buy them while they're now 50p each, because you know in 10 years' time they'll be £10 each on eBay. Mm-hmm. So not with a view to selling them, just getting them while they're cheap so that when I have a space where I can play all these games, I've got more games than I could play in a lifetime, but I keep buying them.
What's wrong with a couple more?
What's wrong with a couple more at 50p each? So, yeah, that's the best you can really do in charity shops over here, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's funny. So a big part of collecting, of my collecting life, has been going through, and I'm sure you've watched Clint, LGR, you know, do his Goodwill section. It's amazing to me that entire scene just is not present in England. So I guess
there is an alternative here in England, which is the car boot sale, or what you'd call the car trunk sale, which is traditionally throughout the summer, everyone just goes to a field with their cars, opens up the back of the car and sells what they've got. Get tables out and lay it out and sell what they've got. So you can sometimes find deals in the car boot sale in a field. But the trouble is now everyone just goes onto eBay to look up what they've got and check the price first. And if it's worth anything more than £10, they won't take it there. They'll sell it on eBay. So
yeah, that, it's just funny because a lot of the best finds come from, you know, sadly, when someone passes away and their family just boxes up all their possessions and gives them to Goodwill, you know, and I saw that a lot when I was working, when I was volunteering at Oxfam in the UK, is that you'd have a record collector that would pass on and their family would get, and you just get, you go out of your mind when you unwrap these things and you see them. So I guess that those things just maybe they find their way sooner or later to one of those great car boot sales that are so
famous. But also you'll find that Oxfam and other charity shops now have an online eBay account.
So they've gotten into that racket too. Well, getting back to our story, there's a company out there called InTech Gaming who have designed an upgraded board for the Nintendo 64 as well as a completely redesigned outer shell and controller. And this thing is called the Warrior 64. And it offers many upgrades that you don't get in your garden variety in 64. So the first thing is that it has full US and Japan cartridge support. It didn't mention European carts, so you guys may be out in the cold here. A fully upgraded video board with HDMI out and brighter colors than other recent HDMI solutions, and a redesigned controller that ditches that classic Trident design in favor of something that looks a little bit more comfortable in the hands. Neil, did you check this thing out? What do you think of the design of the Warrior 64?
Well, I don't really have a problem with the design of the original N64 case.
Yeah, it's pretty good looking case, I thought.
I like it. You know, it's compact. It flows nicely. I like it. And the name Warrior 64 sounds like a tank.
Sort of dumb, yeah.
There is certainly scope to improve on the original controller, and solutions do already exist for that. Case-wise, I like the design, as I said. If you wanted something a bit wackier, because I know you like things wacky, John.
I do.
There's your original case. There's the Pokemon Stadium Edition N64. Mm-hmm. There was a semi-transparent green, orange, and blue one. There was a Zelda one. And these were all official products. So if you're a real collector, guys, that sounds pretentious, doesn't it? If you're a real collector. But, you know.
Like me, Neil from RMC.
Everyone likes the official products, don't they? So there are official ones in all sorts of wacky designs out there. What the Warrior 64 does is it takes away the rounded edges and the lines of the original, and it replaces them with sharp angles. And the best way I could describe this case, if you haven't seen it, is it looks like when I was a kid, if I tried to draw a stealth bomber plane in my maths textbook, you know? And guess what, John? I didn't go on to become an expert in aircraft design. And it just looks like a child drew a stealth plane.
I do get that feeling as well. It's all sharp angles and edges and screams sort of like, I don't know, like you said, like notebook airplane attitude.
Yeah, it doesn't look good at all. The controller looks okay. What they've done with that is, as you say, they've moved the analog stick from the center to the left, where you'd expect to find it on a modern console. It looks comfortable, therefore it probably is a lot more comfortable. So that looks good. And it looks like you can also just plug that into a regular N64, because inside it is an N64 board. So you could take that controller and use it. But there is now a review of the product out there by YouTuber Metal Jesus Rocks, who I'm sure lots of listeners follow. He's got his hands on it. And he's one of the few people who have so far. So we're really going by what we've seen on paper and what's been promised on Kickstarter. And that looks good. What you read about, it looks good. I would look at that and say, yeah, I want that. But he's done a review, and I'm not going to tell you his opinion on it yet. I don't know if you've seen the video yet. But before I do, how much was this thing to back?
Well, the project has already met its Kickstarter goal. So if you want in, and you're going to end up with one of these if you kick in the money. I mean, hopefully, Kickstarter is always a risk. He could take all the money and run. We don't know. But but if you want to build this yourself in kit form, they sell a kit version. It's going to run you about $100. If you want one pre-built, it's going to run you $150. I don't think that's bad, because given what you're getting is an actual N64 board inside, you know, with all of this extra stuff. So this isn't a cheap Chinese system on a chip, or, you know, something that they've created, you know, a custom PCB. This is an actual N64 board with stuff added on it with a new case over it.
Yeah. So that's how it looks on paper. On paper, not a bad deal, in quotes, and you are getting that original board. But the promises don't seem to align with the delivery. So Metal Jesus Rock's review this week It wasn't a review of the system as a whole. Maybe that was what he intended, but it just turned into an angry rant, a really angry rant about the quality of the video output. So what these guys have done is they've made a custom HDMI board that sits on the original system board itself. It taps into the video chip, gives supposedly a nice HDMI output for a modern display. The expectation that they set was that this was going to give a perfect upscaled image like you would get from... There's another product called the Ultra HDMI. It's been around for a couple of years, very similar to something I put in a Dreamcast recently. But in reality, the quality of the output from that, it turns out, is no better than a $30 cable that you can just plug into an existing N64. That's Metal Jesus's opinion. And he does give side-by-side comparisons in his video, and based on that, I am inclined to agree. It's not great. It's not great. It doesn't live up to expectations. So it's not looking great. And on top of that, the big question is, where are they getting these N64 system boards? Are they buying up old N64s and tearing them apart to build these systems? It doesn't add up for me. It doesn't add up for me.
Well, that brings me to another ethical question, Neil. Obviously, the N64 sold a million billion units. So if a small portion of consoles are being ripped from their original shells and upgraded in new cases, the world will probably continue to spin. But my question is, where do you draw the line with this stuff? You know, if people were ripping out 48K speccies out of their original cases to put them in real keyboard housings with upgraded video and all that, would you mourn the loss of these machines? Because, you know, they're obviously never going to be put back in their original state.
It's a funny example that you give, because ripping out 48K spectrums from their cases is exactly what people did back in the day to install them in a case with a proper keyboard. All right, this wasn't a video upgrade, but there were companies like DKtronics who made a proper keyboard for the ZX Spectrum, and you would transplant your board into it. So that was a thing that could be considered a period authentic upgrade.
I guess that's true.
But it is a fine line, isn't it? The most modern upgrade that I performed recently, it was a Sega Dreamcast. And I put that in a brand new case, which was semi-transparent and smoky gray. It was gorgeous. It got a new PSU, an SD card reader instead of the disc laser, an FPGA-based HDMI video output system, a new fan. And here's the best bit, John. We upgraded the LED to blue.
I saw that video, Neil. It still bothers me that you open up the lid and you manipulate that button that is inside the case of the Dreamcast. Yes. Every time you press it, I think you're pressing down on like a CD reader. I'm like, no, don't touch this.
There's a reset button where the laser would be. Yeah. Right. Now, when I do things like that, I always have a box. And anything I take out of a system goes into that box. Is like a plastic box with a clip-on lid. So I store all of those bits away. And that particular mod with the Dreamcast is completely reversible. It would be a pain, but it's possible. And there are comments in the video from people saying, that's not a real Dreamcast anymore. What have you done to it? Which I agree with to a degree. And I understand where they're coming from, but I know that I can reverse it. And I understand that there are people out there who have a real emotional connection with the machine because that's the machine. That was their first machine.
Right.
And so part of that modification, it did involve drilling a hole in the case, but because I'd used a new case, we drilled the hole in the new case. So the original case, we can reverse everything. It's fine, guys. We can reverse it if we want to. Don't panic.
It'll be okay.
Yeah. But if we get to the Warrior 64, is it a destructive modification? Can you revert your N64 back if you want to? Well, I don't know what they've done with those original cases, you know. Have they sold them on? I don't know.
Yeah, my guess is that they have gone into a landfill somewhere. You know, I can't imagine there's a great market for, you know, N64 cases unless they're playing the long game and they're thinking maybe if we sell enough of these things, the original N64s will become so rare that people will be clamoring for the original shells and then we'll make money twice. Who knows?
Maybe they'll do a second Kickstarter where they claim they've made the mold to create new N64 cases, but they just sell the cases they took them out of.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. I love it. So if you're an N64 fan and you plan on getting a Warrior 64 to upgrade your Mario Kart or Ocarina of Time experience, watch the Metal Jesus video first, because don't put money into this thing until you know what you're getting into. But if you do manage to get one and you have a different opinion, send us a message on subreddit. And we want to thank subreddit user Pajaco6502 for submitting this story. Neil, I am on the hunt. I am on the hunt for a new retro computer. I have a shelf full of retro computers, but I'm ready for an all-in-one solution that gives me everything that I want out of my classic computers. I've decided to go the Mr. route, Neil, and I've decided to buy it through RetroBench. RetroBench has something called the Mr. RB500 system, and this thing takes all the guesswork out of building a Mr. computer. It comes with all the parts fully assembled and ready to go, including the I/O board, all the RAM that you need, plus that DE10 nano board, which is the backbone of the FPGA system. Neil, have you had good luck with your Mister?
Oh, I've had a great time with my Mister. And the hardest part about getting a Mister is finding someone who has it in stock. And I know full well that Scott over at RetroBench.com has them in stock and ready to go. So save yourself some time and just head over there if you're in the market for a Mister for sure.
Absolutely. And we want to thank RetroBench for sponsoring This Week in Retro.
John, the ZX Spectrum Next is a great success story, and the second revision of the system smashed the Kickstarter goal. Well over £1.5 million, I think it was closer to £2 million, if not more, was raised by backers, including myself. So it's fair to say there is a demand for this system. But did you know that you can now get a clone of the system? So if you miss the Kickstarter and you don't want to pay the scalper's prices on eBay, you can still get yourself a ZX Spectrum Next. Now, your first instinct might be to ask, is this legal? Is someone ripping off the Next? Should this be allowed? And the answer is that it's all perfectly legit and above board. The origins of the Next project go back to a Brazilian Spectrum clone called the TK. I think it was the 95, might have been the 90. It was one or the other. And that wasn't the only ZX Spectrum clone. There were many all over the world, especially in Brazil and the Russian states, the USSR states. And places like that. And that evolved over time. And the creators of this particular one, the TK, wanted to pitch it back to the UK market, knowing that obviously that's where the biggest market was to sell such a product. And they, of course, had great success doing that. But the team have also actively encouraged people to create clone machines in an effort to expand the user base of the ZX Spectrum Next as much as possible. And that really is not a bad idea when you think about it. The larger the user base, the more software will be written, the more peripherals, the more people want to get involved in it, the better the community. So yes, it's all legit and above board. But John, which would you go for? Would you go for the original clone, the ZX Spectrum Next, or the clone clone? this particular one, it's not the only one out there, by the way. It's just the latest one that's being marketed, is called the Next N-Go. Which would you go for?
Well, I'm lucky enough to already have, you know, several Spectrums in my collection, which is not something a lot of Americans can say. I have a 48K here sitting behind me. I also have a plus two over on the shelf for my 128K needs. So I'm pretty good with original hardware. I think that the next is a specialized package for people who have a certain nostalgia for the system. They want something that's turnkey out of the box. And it's also, I mean, let's be honest, it's for people that want to be part of the club, of the movement. You know, just take a look at some of the quasi-religious postings over on the ZX Next Facebook page. Greetings, true believers. these clone boards are serving an entirely different group of people, I think. I think that there's a subset of people who like to tinker. They want to build their own cases. Or you might have people that they can't quite pony up the full amount for the Next. And they're willing to settle for a more bare-bones, pared-back solution that they can complete piecemeal as funds allow. It looks like that you can add a simple acrylic case for about $10. And of course, you just supply your own keyboard and joystick and away you go. Now, my question is, how big is the audience for the clone? You know, obviously, the audience for the ZX Spectrum Next is huge, massively successful, multiple Kickstarters. They've really done well. I think you're going to run into diminishing returns from a system like this, but at the same time, all you're doing is you're manufacturing a PCB in an acrylic case. So your manufacturing costs are going to be much, much lower. You can make these in much smaller quantities and still make a small amount of money. And so this is just another example of the marketplace being mature, you know, and having price points at all the different levels for whatever your needs are. So I think this is an excellent, you know, idea. It looks like a great product. Unlike the other FPGA solutions that are out there, like the Unamiga, I didn't see any reference to other core compatibility. Obviously, something like the Mister is going to be compatible with tons more stuff, but that's a lot more expensive. The Unamiga is about $50 more than this ZX Spectrum Next clone board. But for $50 more, you get everything that this board does. Plus, it offers cores, core support for the MSX, the NES, and of course the Amiga, in addition to the ZX Spectrum Next. On the other hand, though, you need to have an A500 case to put it in, which also adds to the cost. So I don't know, Neil, I'm torn. What does this appeal to you at all?
Yeah, I'm torn too, because it comes down to price, isn't it? Sometimes you just want to buy something that does one job and you know it's going to do it well. If it's costing you more, sometimes you want to know that it can run those other cores and it can do lots of other things. Price is a big factor in this. The next is FPGA based. So it's running a core on an FPGA chip. That is ultimately the machine, all wrapped up in that. If you look at the Engo board here, you can see how sparsely populated it is and realize it's mostly a system on a single chip with a few peripheral bits and bobs to help it along its way. So as I understand it, the next FPGA core will, if it hasn't already, I haven't checked the news recently, it will be available for the Mister. Perhaps it will be for the Unamiga as well. No doubt it will be adapted to run on other FPGA-based setups. So I already have a system that's capable of running the next core in the Mister that I own.
Mm-hmm.
And I did know that when the second round of the next Kickstarter came up. I was fully aware of this, but I just had to back it. I just had to have the case.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing.
It's a classic-looking design by industrial designer Rick Dickinson, the very same designer of the original ZX Spectrum case, who sadly passed away. So this is his very last design. This is your last chance to buy into something that really connects back to the original Sinclair machines, which is a lovely thing to own. I wanted the lovely manual. They've done a great job with that, which comes with it, the box, all the goodies that come with it. So I'm almost treating the ZX Spectrum Next like I'm an Apple fanboy, how they might treat the latest Apple phone. It's on brand, mm-hmm. It's authentic feeling, and that is why I want it. Whereas this clone board, it doesn't have that feverish appeal to me, but I think there is a market for this, and I think it will help the user base grow. It will satisfy those on a lower budget than the premium Next demands. It will, crucially, fit in an original ZX Spectrum 2B case. Mm. So, you can still get that authentic experience if you've got a spare case to put it in. So to summarize, I'm really glad that it exists for those reasons. The Kickstarter Next is for me, but I fully applaud this, and I think it's a great thing that it exists for those with a lower budget and just slightly different needs to what I have. So, yeah. So if you want to find out more, the place to look this up is ultimatemister.com. Go and check it out and see if it's for you. So thank you for listening to This Week in Retro. Join our show subreddit and contribute your favorite stories from the world of retro.
Help us spread the word about the show by leaving us a review on your podcast app of choice, sharing our Facebook page, or just telling a retro-loving friend. See you next week for more up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.